Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
Today, we are talking about the rapture. We discussed this briefly 2 weeks ago when we were talking about witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
So we figured we wanted to come back and do a more robust treatment of the topic because good chance that it's part of your church experience or your idea about what happens after this life. So I don't know. Did you grow up like with the rapture? Like, did you watch movies and stuff?
Well, it's definitely been a part of what I think takes place. I don't know when though, like at the end, like you, this whole idea of not knowing the time.
Mm-hmm. No one knows the hour.
No one knows the hour.
Yeah.
Of when he's coming back.
Mm-hmm. It's real life.
Definitely kept me in line for a few years.
I think that's the intent of that, just to keep you on your toes.
Pretty much. I mean, a lot of things have been shown to be tools of management of people within a system.
Mm-hmm.
You strip all of that away, and you start asking yourself, now, what is really going on here?
I remember, like, when we were in Vacation Bible School. I don't think it was Vacation Bible School. I think it was like a some camp, overnight, whatever. This was when I was really young. They showed us this movie called A Thief in the Night, which was really popular. It was, A Thief in the Night was this rapture propaganda film.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was like...
You were at a Christian camp, though?
Yeah.
Oh, it was okay.
Late 70s, early 80s.
Wow.
That's how they were dressing.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden, their clothes were just laying in piles on the street, and everyone was terrified and they didn't know what was going on. And it was just like, yo, what happened? Then it was all this bad stuff happening. And I was like, yo, why are you showing this to us? It's like scary.
I'm scared of babies.
So anyway, those are the type of things that stick in the American consciousness or the Christian consciousness when it comes to the rapture. It's this idea that you're going to miss it. And you don't want to miss it.
If you're not careful, you're going to miss it.
So, what is it? Where does it come from? So, the rapture, it leverages this idea of dualism.
Okay.
Like, either things are good or bad. This is a Gnostic idea. So, in this case, the earth is bad.
Heaven is good.
Heaven is good.
Okay.
And for the bad things, they're irredeemable.
They must be destroyed.
Right. So, they need to be destroyed. So, the way the rapture addresses this issue is, there's this rebirth of the nation of Israel. You know what? As I'm researching for all of these shows, like, I learn stuff all the time.
Of course.
I didn't realize Israel didn't become a nation until 1948.
Yes.
Yo, what? Where? I mean, not that I was alive. Ooh, but
history.
That's really recent.
Yeah, it is. And really recent and really controversial. Because now you can see, like, Israel is not even older than my grandmother, and
wow,
she's controversial. So there you go.
So the rebirth of Israel is part of this rapture narrative. And when that happened in 1948, that triggered all of this rapture paranoia where, the clock is starting to tick now that Israel has been established as a state. And then after that, at some point, the rapture occurs, and that's born again Christians are taken out of the earth.
Right.
And everyone who
caught up in the air.
Yeah. Everyone who is left is not good enough. So if you left behind, then you know what your situation is.
I do not mean to laugh, but when I tell you it would be on if people woke up and they ain't go to heaven like they might have been thinking that they were going to go.
That's the fear in most in most Christians who hold this view. They're like, yo, I got to make sure I'm on that train out of here because you ain't leaving me here with all these heathens. They're going to be shooting and killing each other. And I'm not. No, I got to get on the first one out.
Whew.
So after that, at some point, there's this reemergence of this figure or this emergence of this figure called the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and people have been trying to figure out who that figure is.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a lot of people took...
Everyone's the Antichrist. Obama's the Antichrist.
Yeah, and I was going to say that, but you know, it fit into a bigger ideological slant that of course he would be. Because, I mean, who chose that guy to do the things that he was doing. So I think some people picked it up and either revisited it or ran with it. Mm-hmm. That obviously this outlier, this the othering mm-hmm. of him, you know, obviously means he's the devil.
Yeah, and then a lot of the characterizations of the Antichrist are not based in anything other than fiction or
right. what popular, we think sounds you know, popular negative. Ideas.
Mm-hmm. One of those things being is a charismatic figure that basically captures the heart of the world, like Kenneth Hagee, it's two of them. Mm-hmm. They do this thing where it's like it's the Antichrist establishes this one world currency and they come up with all of this stuff.
There was a lot of discussion about this with the emergence of the euro. Yep. So like, this is going to bring about the end of the world.
Right. So every change or advancement that happens, it triggers these fears that, mm-hmm. We're getting closer. That clock that started ticking when Israel was established is now running closer to mm-hmm. the end. So the Antichrist appears. Then Antichrist signs a 7-year peace treaty with Israel. Breaks it after 3.5 years. Then there's a rebuilding of the temple that's in Jerusalem. Now, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD by Nero. So the Antichrist comes and brings that back and then starts to desecrate the temple by sacrificing animals in it.
Mm.
And then Jesus comes back. It's called the second coming, but technically the rapture is almost like a 0.5 because somebody came to get all these people. So Jesus comes back in what's called, not by the Bible, the glorious appearing exactly 7 years after the rapture.
Okay.
All right. Supposedly all of this is biblically based. Mm. Very little of this is mm-hmm. biblically based. Okay. So this idea of the rapture, one, this word is not in the Bible at all. The closest is a Latin word from the Vulgate, raptio, which is not the same thing.
Okay.
But whenever you see like the phrase caught up or something like that, that's read as that's the rapture.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. that's, again, that's popular culture making its way into biblical interpretation.
Right.
All right. So when did it start? It started over 180 years ago. All right. It was a 15-year-old girl in Glasgow, Scotland, Margaret MacDonald. In 1830, she attended a healing service. In that service, she had a vision of a 2-stage return of Jesus. Now, up until this point, Jesus had left the church at the ascension and was plans to return at the second coming.
Mm-hmm.
This girl, Margaret MacDonald, said that there's 2 stages. That second stage was that intermediate rapture period. Mm-hmm. Okay. She didn't have a fleshed out concept of what this is, but that happened over time. So her story is picked up by John Nelson Darby, who invented, he's responsible for the dispensations, the seven intervals of time of this grand timetable of God. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Darby's view became popular. Then it was bolstered by the Scofield Study Bible. I grew up with a Scofield Study Bible in my house. Didn't know anything. Didn't know any better.
Okay.
This Bible was basically universally panned by all biblical scholars.
Okay.
This is ridiculous interpretations of some of these things, particularly the eschatological portions, Daniel 9 and things like that. So Scofield Bible sold everywhere. Like I said, I had one. Well, I didn't have one. I wasn't buying Bibles when I was a kid, like especially no giant Bibles home. Like that. Yeah, but it was there. So this was later picked up, this idea of these dispensations, which was picked up by Moody Bible Institute. They had these conferences where they would host them. Then eventually there was a Zionist named Louis Schaeffer who founded this training center, the Presbyterian Dispensationalist Training Center, which is now called Dallas Theological Seminary, 1924. Yep.
Okay.
I mean, people who go to DTS know it's a evangelical seminary and it comes out of, you know. And I'm not saying that the seminary is bad. We're just talking
this
about
is just where it's
yeah.
rooted.
This is just the history of how we got there.
Okay.
I mean, I know some fine people who graduated from DTS. We may have some arguments, but that has nothing to do with any of this.
Right.
All right. That's where we are. So
that's where we are. That's the background.
Right. So the rapture is something that came out of that. It's less than 200 years old, but it has made its way into our ideas about what happens. Yep. And so much so that we may not know any other ideas. Like, we may think that's just the truth.
We challenge it. I don't think that it comes up enough or a lot. I can't say that it's come up a lot. I feel like, at least in my conversations, which
y'all don't talk about the rapture a lot,
because we too busy. Okay, we're too busy basically saying we ain't gonna be here and living. But I don't know. I just feel like there's a number of ideas. You know, sometimes our topics, we just go over things and we be like, number one, it's not even in the Bible, mm-hmm. and I know people be like, what?
Yeah, huh? Man.
Yeah, it's not even there.
I mean, I would recommend looking. I mean, don't just take our word for it. But yeah, they're not going to do that.
I feel like this is why I know. You say we haven't been kicked out of churches. It's going to happen.
All right. So what is the impact of this eschatology, this view of the end times?
Right.
One, it is a fascinatingly compelling story. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes for great. Well, not so great. It makes for interesting fiction. Now, the Left Behind series that came out in the 90s by Tim LaHaye and Jerry mm-hmm. B. Jenkins, this thing is what really...
It was huge.
I mean, it was huge.
It was huge.
And at the time, so I bought all of the books. I think it was 7 books.
And the internet was not what it is today.
Right, right. So yeah. You really just had, you know, you sit down with these books and you have all these great... At the time, I knew people were reading them. I read them multiple times. Because, one, there's this fear that you don't want to be left. But mm-hmm. two... You also want to know what happens to the people who get left behind. I bet you they're going to be pissed that they ain't accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. I want to see what happens. Is God going to let us watch it on TV? How is it going to work? So you want to see what, and this book kind of gave you an idea. These books gave you an idea of kind of what goes on after mm-hmm. you out of here. Mm-hmm. Cause you did the right thing. And right. So, but in hindsight, this is terrible fiction. Like, the thing is, I'm reading this and I'm like, these books are so great. But at the time, I was still like a teenager. I hadn't read a lot of fiction before. Like, I had read stuff, but not really a lot, to the point where I hadn't read good fiction. And the reason why I know is I was at this conference in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
No, Colorado Springs.
Okay.
And there's an artist, there's a writer, his name is Frank Peretti. He writes Christian fiction, usually of the horror variety. And yeah, it's like demons and stuff like that.
But okay.
Peretti is actually a decent writer. So one of in the writer's workshop, he was talking about the fact that you have this difficulty in Christian fiction where you have to write characters that are bad, but the characters can't do things like cuss and do just simple bad things. And so you end up having these really clean villains that Christians buy because they don't want to see cussing in their books. But somebody who doesn't read Christian fiction looks at that and like, what's so bad about this guy? Like, why is this person a villain? And so the problem is, if you write profanity in the book, you can't get it in the Christian bookstores. But if you don't write the profanity in the book, you get it in those bookstores, but then it just sucks.
Yeah.
So, you know, you read stuff that you know that they want to say stuff like, you know, they killed this person or they, you know, maybe they doing this bad thing, whatever. They just can't write it. They have to leave it to your imagination. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm reading these books in the 90s thinking it's great, but really it's just playing off the fear that I have. It's not that the writing is great. It's just that it's telling a really interesting story.
And it's not just books. So these ideas of something big coming lead people to do things to either prepare for it or how are they going to manage something big coming. The fact that we call it a rapture, this idea that caught up in the air, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to get caught up in the air. We is all going to heaven. So for the people who are here, you know, you might not think about it, but think about people who do like doomsday prepping or who I think there's something altruistic and holistic behind gardening and, mm-hmm. you know, taking better care of our homes and taking care of better care of our bodies. But there are some people who are deeply invested in these types of actions because they are using it to prepare for, to repel negative outcomes related to this idea. So it's Left Behind was a huge series. Yep. And I believe it was on TV or
they had
some
movies,
Christian channel. Okay.
Kirk Cameron made a series of movies with it. Nicolas Cage made one recently.
Okay.
Which is a Nicolas Cage type of movie. And so anyway, so they had books, they had movies, they had in Left Behind story, firearms played a prominent role in the people who were left behind protecting themselves. So gun sales spiked after this because a lot of the Christians are like, well, I'm not getting left behind, but just in case, they're not taking my stuff.
I see, but I just feel as though that there are people who are prepared to get left behind because they know that their hearts ain't right.
Right. That's easy. Let me just stockpile guns and I'm going to be ahead of the game.
And I'm just going to kill anybody who tries to kill me. But see, you only preparing for that because you know you kind of sliding to the left. It's fine. Go ahead.
The rapture became this whole cottage industry where it bolstered different markets within the world as people started to think through and prepare and things like that. It also went to other areas. It's something when something hit that big. I'm trying to think of the next comparable idea, because that's you got a Christian work that ends up weaving its way into people's religious beliefs, and not the other way around. Yeah. It's so I don't know that there's something like that.
We got to figure it out. We would have to spend a little bit more time on something like
maybe
that.
Maybe the Da Vinci Code was something like that.
I was going to say.
But the Da Vinci Code didn't hit nowhere near as hard as Left Behind.
No. I don't think. The only other thing that might have caused as big of a stir, but I don't think it's for the same reasons, was the Passion of the Christ that I feel like a lot of people were up in arms for because they wanted to deride that as so anti-Semitic.
Right. Yeah, that's right. They did have a controversy.
Yeah. Like that was something that people chomped on for a long time because of how graphic that film was to show the persecution of Christ. But there were voices that said, we don't appreciate this alluding to this, I don't know, age old idea, critique, you know, certain people's beliefs that there were actual Jewish people, the priesthood that contributed to Christ's crucifixion. And they did not like that depiction. And that conversation was more so just held in the critique of the film until Mel Gibson, we don't even talk about this anymore, but Mel Gibson got in trouble for his anti-Semitic rant and it brought that back up again, like you did it on purpose.
I got it. The last thing that I know that had this type of impact was Dante's Inferno. Now, I wasn't alive when Dante's Inferno was written because that was in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
But Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, with the different levels of hell.
Right, that shaped
the illustrations. Yeah.
We think about hell in terms of Dante's Inferno, in the same way we think about the end times or eschatology in Left Behind series.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's that big. And we're still trying to unravel our ideas of hell in terms of what the Bible says versus what's in art.
Yep.
And that's the same situation here with what happens after this. So it has this huge impact, but it also has impact in some of our legislation. So we have a whole show on Israel.
Yes.
Okay.
The nation state.
The nation state of Israel. But after Left Behind, or even after this idea, not just Left Behind, but this idea of this rapture and all of the things that we outlined happens, there was this sense on behalf of this country to make sure it stays aligned with Israel. Because at the end, when God descends from heaven to New Jerusalem, you want to make sure that New Jerusalem, one, is there for God to come down to, and two, that you've shown that you were on the right side.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of logical flaws with that thinking. Anyway, it starts to shape foreign policy with regard to the nation state of Israel.
Right.
And so, we're not going to risk
going
that twice.
Here.
So anyway, there's a whole episode about that. It's called Let's Talk About Israel. Also, it affects how we view the environment. We did a show about this 3 weeks ago where we were talking about people have this idea that God is going to fix it, whatever it is, with the environment. Like, it doesn't matter. The earth has to deteriorate to such disrepair before the good events happen, the glorious appearing happens, and then God restores the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so You don't, there's no obligation to take care of the earth. There's this environmental apathy, right, because we know that God's fixing this. If we were to apply that logic to, let's say, our bodies, like, how would that look? Like, God is going to restore our bodies. We're going to get these glorified, right, bodies.
So we can eat as much as we want.
Do whatever we want.
Yep.
Don't take care of ourselves. You know, if we get sick, it doesn't matter. We don't.
Because we're getting a new one.
Right. You're just getting a new one.
Mm-hmm.
It is a, you better be right if that's what you believe.
Go on and say it. It's not meant to be comfortable.
The problem with this thinking is it puts the Christians in place to be the worst stewards of the environment. Because they believe this, they don't have any incentive to take care of the environment, which dictates how you vote. Because why would you vote to protect something that it doesn't matter because God is just going to make it over anyway?
If that's your overall belief.
This thing permeated the American consciousness so thoroughly that we've given up on the earth.
Wow, that sounds profound.
We're doing the show because, well, all of the shows, because we believe that they're important. But you cannot avoid that apathy that comes with the security of an omnipotent being fixing all of your mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get past that part of it. That apathy looks like you ignoring deteriorating conditions. So as the earth is getting worse, you believe that we're getting closer to the end or closer to the part where you win.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's so self-serving. You're like, I don't care what happens here. I'm getting out of here. And so I see stuff going wrong and I'm like, yep, I told you. Do you want to accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior? Because I'm getting ready to leave.
Yeah, that's a different gun to your head. That's a different gun. I mean, that's the type of language I use. That's what we're talking about.
And then what's even worse, not only do you ignore those deteriorating conditions, you also ignore when conditions improve. You root against that because you don't want to slow your clock down. Like, I thought we were getting closer to the end.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. The earth is getting better. People are getting better. They're treating each other better. This thinking is so backwards.
So humans are not holistic by nature. We are fascinated with our ultimate demise. We are fascinated with how it would affect our senses. We're fascinated with the methods by which we could bring about a life's end or the ending of something's existence, right? So it's one thing when you think about it for yourself, right? And we recognize that as something that requires intervention. Somebody wants to harm themselves. We orient ourselves to intervene as much as possible because there is this equal and opposite value to life. We say, no, life is worth living. You know, don't do that. Don't harm your friends and family that way. Don't harm yourself that way. But when we begin to look at all of the different systems that we participate in, all the different things that rely on us to stay alive or to be, you know, to perpetuate, to continue on, then we start making conditions. So with this particular thing, keep in mind, if somebody listens to this whole season, it's like we're painting a picture, whether we intended to or not. But this conversation takes us to a place that surrogacy touched on, that the Earth Day episode touched on. And there are a few more there that the titles are escaping me. But if you listen to what we're talking about what is going to be the real price to pay between how we behave as humans and how we behave within the constructs of what we say are our religious beliefs or the theologies that we ultimately believe. We are unintentionally, but definitely with a lot of purpose, forcing the question, do you really believe a lot of the stuff that is put in front of you for your consumption?
Mm-hmm.
Because 9 times out of 10, you didn't even make that plate. That is not your food. So we are not in a position in society where we are dictating this. 9 times out of 10, we are going along with it, right? So we've talked about groupthink at the polls and, you know, who's leading from behind and who's doing all of these things. It's the people who are like, a lot of this stuff don't make sense. And when heads begin to roll or repercussions begin to be meted out or consequences to start being spread around, it's going to be the people who were least powerless to change it that will probably bear its brunt, right? So if you believe in a rapture that's going to undo all of your earthly misdeeds, you have no incentive to not continue to have earthly misdeeds. So if you are a compromised soldier, or if you are a when I say morally compromised, you're not even acting within the rules of engagement that you've been given for your profession. When you are a compromised law enforcement officer, if you are not afraid of being held accountable for your own actions, you do not then turn around and in society where you operate, change those actions just because. Mm-hmm. If you are out here murdering, you will continue to murder. If you are out here maiming, you will continue to maim. If you are harming children, that is what you're going to continue to do because you've already created your own loophole. Mm-hmm. I ain't gonna be here to deal with it anyway. We see this when you say this thing is starting to show up in our policies or show up in our legislation. A lot of the things that we do and don't have, we're talking about universal health care. You know why people are like, you don't need it? Because they're like, get your soul right. Mm. They're selling you that if your soul is right, it won't matter if you can get treatment for cancer.
Right, because you're going to be taken care of anyway.
Because you're going to heaven. And see, I don't have to reduce my compensation. I don't have to change my business model. I don't have to reduce the price of my drugs. I don't have to compensate my doctors at a wage that reflects their preparation or reflects their professionalism. See, I don't have to do all of that because ultimately I vote in a way that says, as long as I pay tithes, if I even do that, then I'm not going to have to deal with all of the things I allow to go wrong because it fits my purview of what my worldview of how this thing is supposed to go anyway. But I'm already sitting on top of a system that I built or was built for me to benefit from. That looks inherently different if I'm on the bottom of that system.
So you think, not you, someone in that position.
It might be me.
No, it's not you, not for this. Someone in that position who is benefiting from a system and also failing to act in a system somehow thinks they're good enough to get out of here on the first. Like,
yes,
you,
I do.
You're not. They would think.
Oh, yeah.
They
but
would
this
think,
is what they think.
I'm getting out of here on a rapture, even though I've participated and enabled and reproduced this oppression. The way oppression works under this construct, oppression works as a confirmation bias because it says as things get worse. That's exactly what the Bible said was going to happen.
Yeah.
And so there's no need for me to help.
And my actions that contribute to making it worse will be absolved because I'm not going to be here anyway. I did it because I was trying to bring about this bigger timeline in happening or this bigger, you know, event chain to happen. It doesn't matter that I myself am a corrupt politician.
What also doesn't matter in this line of thinking or to a person could think this, let's say for instance in the 80s with crack, I see it getting bad, those poor people, I can't help them, it doesn't matter, God will help them. But then in 2018, 2019 with the opioid crisis, it's like, wait a minute, we got to do something.
It's the ditch that you dug for other people that was big enough for you to fit in. And we see that in real time. We see it. We're getting ready to see it with like, well, how are we going to manage some of these debt systems that we have? Mm-hmm. People who are proposing student debt relief are not doing it for the benefit of the people who are holding the debt. Mm-hmm. But there's no way that you can talk about, let's say, Black women being the largest demographic moving through higher education and obtaining multiple degrees. And it's disingenuous to say that student loan relief is not going to directly help,
right?
You know, some Black women, you know, financially or help them manage their households. It's the convergence of the data. Statistically, you know, I used to tell my students all the time, the data says that your life is going to go a certain way. There's a probability of you fitting certain identifiers or fitting certain characteristics. Here's what I want. I just want you to make the most money you can as you move through that, right? So I don't know whose data set it was that might have said that African-American women will probably lead, I don't know, I'm making stuff up, y'all. But let's say they said that we were going to lead 65% of Black households as single parents. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. I just want you to be an engineer doing that. Mm. because I want you to make more money. It's going to be the convergence of the data sets. The statistics say that you have a higher probability of living this way. And I'm saying that you could either do that on this money or you could do it on this money. Mm-hmm. I cannot stop the ultimate convergence of the data set if you fit those characteristics. But if that is going to be something that you experience, wouldn't you want to experience that on a six-figure salary as opposed to under $40,000?
And so now we moved into the people. So we saw how it affects foreign policy, mm-hmm. how it affects the environment, and also how it affects people, how we deal and interact yeah. with people, the systems of oppression we participate in, also just the level of compassion that you're able to have for another human being. So I would look at that Black woman who went through grad school, got her PhD, and is, you know, over $100,000 in debt, and I would say that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
God is going to, I can't wait till God fixes all this. Instead of actually getting off my
But I'm a banker. And I'm a banking CEO,
mm-hmm.
and I have a seat at the table that determines the policy. And every engagement at that table, we artificially steer the policy away from the majority of the people that it would help, but we are sure to pay ourselves.
Right.
That type of thing. But it doesn't just happen in these smaller groups. It happens when we talk about a lack of diversity when discussing problem solving, mm-hmm. right? So if you have a situation and it's all male minds on the problem and you do not invite a woman's perspective because of a myriad of reasons, mm-hmm. you have not locked her out as much as you have locked out whatever contribution she could have had
right.
to ultimately solving the problem. It's the same thing with homogenous groups, race-wise or ethnicity-wise or nationality-wise. You don't see the same problem. That border issue looks different depending on what side of the border you live on. It looks different depending on what state you're in.
Absolutely.
It looks different depending on what gender you identify with. It just looks different
yeah.
depending. But if at every turn, when you are at whatever table it is that you have a seat at, you decide that I don't really have to help you. I'm going to stand down in this moment mm-hmm. and not use my power to assist you because I am kicking that can down the road mm-hmm. to, you know, the God body who will ultimately assist you. I do not ever atone for becoming a barrier to ultimately your problems not getting solved.
And still believe that you're good enough to get out of
here. Yes, because that is cognitive dissonance. Because you believe that you denied goodness to other people for a good reason.
To hasten the return of Christ.
And who wouldn't want that? But again, I feel like dealing with a species mm-hmm. that is just as sure as we come into consciousness that we are alive, you begin to think about what does it mean to not be alive,
mm-hmm.
right? So again, like Biggie, well, somebody said, I think it was Biggie, 6 million ways to die. So
Snoop. No, that was on.
It was on somebody.
Serial killer on six million ways to die.
Choose one. So when you think about that, like I've heard it before, but then it's like 6 million ways. Like, yo, that's a lot of ways. But even if it was an exaggeration, every day I read in the news somebody dying, some type of crazy out of the box. A gunshot wound is like a dime a dozen at yeah. this point. But you got people who are falling or who tripped and hit their head. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. just random stuff. So we are preoccupied with this.
Yeah.
The bigger the system, the bigger the amount of people we're talking about, the greater risk we're willing to take with somebody else's life.
Right. So the rapture, we're giving you the facts. You make your decision. This is something that is not in the Bible. It has to be read
y'all
into
need to
the
fix
Bible
y'all stuff.
Instead of read from the Bible. So you want to make sure that you're doing that. This is something that is relatively new, starting in 1830. We trace the history of that. The other thing that you need to know is there are and have always been other ideas,
mm-hmm.
not this. And in Christendom, those ideas have existed longer, much longer than this has existed. I mentioned last week C.S. Lewis. So you have, on one hand, you have the Left Behind series,
mm-hmm.
which is this one dispensationalist view of what happens. C.S. Lewis writes another series called The Chronicles of Narnia. Some people may be familiar with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yes.
That was the book two or three in that series. The last book of that series called The Last Battle. It's a Christian allegory story wrapped in fantasy. And Aslan, who is the Christ figure in the story, when things are remade, it's not that everything is reset. It's not that God just does everything over. So to get into Narnia, it's these kids in England, and they go into this wardrobe and they get into Narnia. But at the end, to go into the heaven area, they just go deeper into the wardrobe. But it's the same Narnia. The only difference is everything is more vivid. So you've been there, like you've been there the whole time. What you live in is what you end up living in. That is like the vision, like, but everything is like ice cream tastes better, or Turkish Delight tastes even better in this new, deeper Narnia. Like I said, blues are bluer. Everything is real. You're not seeing. And that's the idea that has existed in Christianity far longer than this new dispensationalist view.
Yeah.
The New Testament, they believed that Jesus was coming back like soon. Because that's what Jesus said, I'll be back soon. And so for the first 30, 40 years, they lived as if Jesus was coming back. But unlike doomsday preppers and people preparing for the rapture, they didn't do that. They didn't store up supplies. They ended up giving what they had other people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the natural, that's an alternative response to this. If you believe that the clock is ticking down, I'm not saying you shouldn't believe that.
I don't, but whatever.
Why are you hoarding? Why aren't you giving stuff away? Why
if
aren't you being
like
more charitable?
Why are you hoarding?
Right. Just help everyone else have a better time. And maybe they'll want to hear about your old raggedy funky God that was just going that was just going to kill everybody and just leave. So there's other ways to look at this. I mean, just caring for each other is a response to whatever you believe
love
about
this.
Love
is a revolutionary act of resistance. Love is a revolutionary act of resistance. You really want to get on somebody's nerves? Love what they don't love. Love what they don't love about themselves. Love people that they don't love. Love longer. Love better. Love deeper. I keep saying that. I say this about relationship and building up the community even within our own homes, right? I see a lot of people who are chronically unattached, okay, for whatever reason, chronically unattached. And I'm saying, what if you put an insane amount of love on that thing? Like a ridiculous amount, like more love than you think it should take. Love for yourself. Love for your activities, love for how you look, how you interact with people, loving your words, loving your actions, just becoming like that warmth, that light, right? So you, because we have such a, that lack of it, it hardens you. It's like people who drink juice all the time and then they finally get some water and they be like, I don't even like water, but the water is the best thing they've had because it's not just empty fluid and empty calorie going through their body, but it's actually life-giving, right? So I don't even like water, but damn, it hits different when I'm thirstier than I've ever been. Imagine putting love on the things that keep you unattached, unfulfilled, unhappy, you know, distant, despondent, hopeless, helpless. Imagine just throwing ridiculous heart emojis at that whole situation. Like you was only going to send 2, send 8. I recently had a conversation with someone where I said, I've been working so hard on it. Like, I'm not in love. I am it.
Wow.
I am it. I put it in everything I say and I do. Even the hard, firm things. Even when I'm standing up for myself. Even when I'm going out on a limb. I'm doing that out of love. I work through it. There might have been some fear there. There might have been some resentment there. There might have been confusion there. I keep working at certain things until there is love there. So that I can have more.
So do that.
Do that.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.